So let's end with a question that I think will tie into Mirage and also Court of Lions. Mm-hmm. This is a really great question I got on Instagram for you. Lost culture is the theme in Mirage. How does this relate to today? I mean, I guess I'd just like to hear, like, how did you think about lost culture in the world of Mirage? How is that going to play into Court of Lions? And, like, what's interesting to you about that as a theme?
So, so my mother is an immigrant from Morocco. I think everybody knows this. And I speak some Darija, which is the Arabic dialect in Morocco, spoken in Morocco. And I was trained in Fusha, which is classical Arabic, as a kid because I went to religious school, and that's part of the curriculum. But up until, I don't know how old I was, I thought of my mother as Arab because she spoke Arabic, obviously. And I thought she spoke three languages, English, French, and Arabic. And then at some point in the last 10 years, I realized that she was not Arab. She was Amazigh, which is the collective term for indigenous peoples in North Africa. She was Shluhi. Her mother is Shluhi and her father is Sahrawi, which are two groups in Morocco. I'm not going to get into that divergence. And that she also spoke a fourth language, Tishlahit, which is the indigenous language of her mother's people. And I found out she spoke Tishlahit because I'd asked her about it. Me and my sisters had all asked her about it for years. And she was like, I don't remember. And then my sister went with her to Morocco a few years ago. And she and her high school best friend were talking. And the thing about Darija Arabic is that it's only considered Arabic for sociopolitical reasons. Linguistically, the proportion of indigenous languages in Darija should take it out of the running as an Arabic language. It is incomprehensible to anyone who doesn't speak a version of Darija, right? Like, people from the Levant and the Gulf are like, that's not Arabic. We don't know what you're saying, for the most part. And so when my sister heard her talking to her best friend, it sounds like Darija, but she couldn't understand anything that they were saying. And it was such a weird, like, can you imagine, like, hearing someone speak English and being like, I don't understand what you're saying. Why don't I understand what you're saying? And it's because they were speaking Tishlahit. And so we realized that our mother had either forgotten Tishlahit for our entire lives, or she had pretended not to know it because there was legislation in Morocco about speaking indigenous languages in the classroom.
Whoa.
Which is changing. But she grew up in the 60s, which is also, like, a really difficult political time in Morocco. So, which I've talked about extensively. And so I think for all kids of immigrants, they're in this weird place because not all immigrants to the United States, like, their parents didn't necessarily flee war. Like, my mom came to the United States because she got married to an American. And, but there is a sense of, like, you can't inherit everything because you're not living there. And there's also a disconnect. Like, my mother understands conversations of cultural appropriation, but the stakes for her are non-existent because she grew up in a place where you can't appropriate Moroccan culture in Morocco because everyone is Moroccan and the power dynamics are entirely different. Whereas for me, like my mother does not understand me and my sister's, like, frustration with, like, how pop culture loves the Hamsa. She's like, whatever. Because you go to Morocco and it's, like, stitched into all the clothing, you know? It's like, she's like, whatever. And we're like, white people don't, like, this is not, you know? And so talking to a lot of my friends who are, like, first or second generation immigrants, we all have these same experiences of, like, having these weird moments where, like, you learn this new thing about your parent that, like, there's no context in their new life in America where you would have learned that about them, right? Like, I don't go to protests because it freaks my mother out, because when she was in college, you got arrested at protests because Morocco had a socialist communist movement, and the government did not like that. And if you were a woman and you got arrested, you got a particular form of violence. And so my mother has, like, a real anxiety about us going to protests. So I don't go to protests because it's just easier. And that sort of thing. And so when I sat down to write Mirage, which is about, like, the frame story is that this girl has grown up in a world where her moon and her and the mother planet have been colonized. And she doesn't remember the occupation or the conquest wave. She's just living in the after. But she's living with her mother and her father, who lived prior to the conquest, survived the conquest, and now have to live in the after, and mm-hmm. they can see the shadows. And so for me, I was like, how do you write about that honestly and authentically? Like, what is that like? What is the hunger for the gaps that you can see, mm-hmm. like, right? Like, there's a lot of poetry in Mirage, and there's more poetry in Court of Lions. And my mom and I talked about it a lot because she helped me with the translation. And she was just very fascinated by how much I really liked it. And I was like, this is a window into... And there's not, like, some of the... All of the poetry is medieval. So, like, what we think of as Morocco didn't actually exist in that time. And so the sort of cultural language borders that we think of as defining where poetry comes from don't exist. But in Arabic-speaking countries, you learn all of the old Arabic poetry. Mm. And so she was familiar with all of the people that I was translating to some extent, and she was just fascinated by how much I loved it. Which I found interesting because she was a literature major in college, and this was the stuff that she loved.
Yeah.
But I think, like it would be if, I guess, like, I had a kid and they were fascinated by Tennyson. And I'd be like, well, I just, you know, I know Tennyson super intimately. It's super strange to me that you find this so fascinating or whatever. And so I think that there is a sense in some ways, or there was a sense prior to this presidency and administration, of like, we have moved past the gaps of colonial trauma or whatever, or obviously, no one who has a history in a colonized space would have ever agreed with that. But the popular narrative is we're post-colonial. Like, that's an entire field, right? And I say that as a post-colonial scholar. Like, we're post-colonial. And it's like, we're only post-colonial because colonialism won.
Right.
Right? And so, like, how do you live in that? And that, I mean, I think that's the very obvious, like, analog to Mirage. Like, how do you live in the after of colonialism, and is there a way to win against colonialism, and how do you move past the difficulty of the after, because colonialism is not like a limb you can chop off, right? It's it gets its tentacles into everything, and it makes everything more complicated, so that if you're a biracial citizen living post-colonialism, pre-colonialism, it's just that your mom and dad cross borders to be with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But post-colonialism, that becomes your biracial identity, becomes bound up in all of the different sort of power structures that, like, mobilize or enable you to move through particular spaces and prevent other people from moving through those spaces. And so I wanted to ask those questions, and I wanted to feel my way through them. I don't know that I answered anything because I don't know how to solve colonialism.
Yeah, I was going to say answer would be pretty presumptuous.
Right, yeah. The answer is chop off the head. Guillotine.
Revolution.
It was interesting to do research for it, because I did a lot of research of, like, post-colonial Morocco, which was a super interesting time, because Morocco is trying to assert sort of a national identity, and that manifests in, like, fascist ways.
Right.
And so I think some people found the research confusing, because I wasn't researching, like, French colonial Morocco. I was researching what comes after. But because how Morocco thought about indigenous identity and how that got legislated happened post-colonial Morocco. Mm-hmm. The French just wanted to kill everybody.
Right. Yeah. They're not great.
Yeah.
But you did that. I feel like you were able to access, narratively, you allowed yourself to talk about a lot of these things because the two characters are such, they're so different in class. They're so different in perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted, I read a review from a very young person, I think. So, like, I'm compassionate to this person. I'm glad that, like, they enjoyed the book. But they came away from the book believing that the point of the book was to to convince people that if people from both sides just talk to each other, then we would come to a better understanding of each other's humanity. And first of all, no. I'm so sorry. The world is not that kind. But second of all, it's really important to remember that Maram is a child. Mm-hmm. She's 17 or 18, but that's not a person that has power in the system.
Right.
And her core conflict is realizing that she's about to become an adult with power. And how does she use that power? Mm-hmm. And that conflict only happens for her because she's straddling the race line, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because on a level, she understands that her father's people will never fully respect her because they view her as a diluted version of the pure thing that they want. Mm-hmm. And so the conversation that Amani and Maram have would not have happened if Maram was fully Vathek. Mm-hmm. And also would not have happened if Amani had not been able to intercede prior to her becoming an adult, mm-hmm. right? Because when you become an adult, then your decisions are your own and you are forced to make decisions, right? And those decisions reflect on you. And the conversation that happens between Maram and Amani is about youth, right? Being kids under empire and trying to figure out how you're going to be as an adult, mm-hmm. and how do you emerge from your trial by fire, right? And again, that only becomes possible because Maram is biracial. I've gotten the sense from some readers that they're like, well, she's one of the Vath, but she's really complicated. And I think if you talk to any biracial person, which I am one, mm-hmm. It's such a complicated identity because you are always both. Mm-hmm. It's not a percentage thing. You're always fully both, but also you encounter all of the time people who think that you are neither.
Oh.
From both sides. Like, not people outside of those sides, but I have had, you know, Moroccans be like, well, you're black, and black people say, well, you're Arab, which I'm not, but okay. You know, and that's a really complicated position that in a person who wants to creates a level of empathy that Maram is able to, or is attempting to articulate, like the sad robot. She's having a time. Yeah, but her position. And I think the empathy that readers feel to her is only possible because she's in this difficult position. If she was just a Vathek person, she could be compassionate, obviously,
of course.
Right? But then the demands that we made on her as readers, I think her inability or her fear to fulfill them then are just cowardice. There's no stakes to being a colonial oppressor,
mm-hmm. Right,
that is not in any way tied to the conquered population and being afraid to make a choice, right? You're just a coward.
Yeah.
And Maram is a scared girl who is trying to who is haunted by the legacy of her mother and also understands that she, like the consequences of just losing her father are catastrophic.
Right.
And that's really difficult. Anyway, I feel like we've gotten far away from the question.
Well, I was kind of diving into what Court of Lions is exploring and what, throughout the series, but.
Yeah, Court of Lions. I'm really proud of Court of Lions. I'm really excited for readers to read it. Maram has a POV.
Yay. So yeah, that's right. I guess I should have established. That's part of why this is so interesting is because we do get way more perspective. Yeah,
you get way more time with Maram. If you've read the Star Wars comics or any of the Star Wars comics, there's a Leia comic, which I haven't read, but I've seen this panel and I remember I put it, I think I made it like my laptop wallpaper or something. And so it's Leia, she's on Naboo, and it's after she realizes that she's not Bail, she's not an Organa, she's mm-hmm. a Skywalker. Spoiler. But she's going through the Naboo Royal Palace in Theeds, and she sees it's like a colored glass mosaic of Amidala, and there's like a force moment where the portrait looks at her, right? And that was the guiding principle for Maram's chapters.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. It's really cool that you found like a visual
George
touchstone.
Lucas just gives me shit that he doesn't know what to do with, and I'm like, I'll fix it.
I'll take
Don't
it from
sue
here.
Me, George Lucas.
I'll take it from here. He can only go so far. You know what I mean? That's okay. He did a lot. Yeah. This has been so fun. I really appreciate you weighing in on all this stuff. And thanks for joining me.
Yeah, I had a good time.
Yay.